listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kurula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
This is your host with the most, Nikki Kurula. We're going to jump right into this interview. We have jazz pianist and producer extraordinaire, Mr. Greg Spiro. Did I say your name correct?
Yes, Nikki, you got it. Greg Spiro, like spear.
That's right.
Spiro, exactly.
That should be your producer name, Spear.
Spear, G Spear. No, I've got many people call me G Money. I've got Sparrow.
Cool.
Little so bird.
What's the ethnicity of Spiro?
Spiro, it knows German. It's German. Okay. There was a tribe of Jews living in Germany in the 16th century in a little town called Speyer. This town is still called Speyer. And they got kicked out of Germany at some point, migrated to Russia, got kicked out of Russia, migrated to Poland, lived in Krakow for a while, and then got kicked out of there, moved to the U.S. in the 19th century, and they changed their name. They kept their town name as their last name because, you know, originally Jews didn't have last names. We were just like that. Our last name would either be our town or our profession, like baker, butcher,
right?
Those are, you know, That's so
interesting. I never knew that there was that sect of people that kind of like went around and kind of landed in Germany. That's kind of an interesting story. It's very cool. So do you have any kind of ancestors that you know? Like, have you traced your roots back parts?
I've traced some roots. There are Spiros in Krakow. There's actually a little museum of the families, the farming families that lived in Krakow, you know, centuries ago. And there are Spiros there. And like, it goes a long way back. It's quite interesting. You know, it makes you realize what a little blip of history we're living in right now. When you think of how our ancestors were very much like us, like how they lived.
Well, you know, what's interesting too. It's like, we're so lucky how we can document life and time and kind of like have kind of a trace. Whereas you see that, you know, back then it's harder to find materials to kind of trace your family tree, and you have to do a lot of digging, where it's like now it's so easy to kind of put the pieces together, you know. So it's awesome that you even did that homework. That's really cool.
It is easy. Yeah, it's easier to put the pieces together now. It's interesting to think of what it'll be like in like 1,000 years, assuming the human race is still around then, because there's a thing called bit rot that happens. It's as programming changes, as programming languages evolve, older data becomes unusable. So it's actually possible that all the data that we're aggregating now and this plethora of information and knowledge we feel like we have, it could actually all go away.
Wow.
By some seismic incident, or just by the simple fact that technology evolves and at some point somebody doesn't make the effort to translate from the old to the new.
That's a lot of TikTok videos that are going to be just vanished from history.
Thank fucking God. Can I swear on this?
You can. You can fucking swear on this.
Okay, good.
Greg, you and I met yesterday. We actually, you know, I was reading your bio and I'm like, man, we got so many parallels. First of all, I love that Herbie Hancock became like a mentor in your life. I actually did a concert with him and Wayne Shorter right out of college. They did this amazing performance with like a bunch of USC Thornton School of Music grads. And we had like a 20-piece band. Herbie Hancock and Wayne Shorter performed. And we were all doing Santana covers because it was a humanitarian award concert for Carlos Santana. So it was pretty wild and pretty crazy. But I remember.
When was that? How long ago was that?
I want to say 2002. and it was in Santa Monica. Oh, okay. It was wild. It was Nestor Torres, Herbie Hancock, Wayne Shorter, and they all gave us like pep talks in our dressing rooms. We got to like with them. It was pretty heavy. Yeah, when I was reading the stuff about how you got into Buddhism, and Herbie Hancock like basically became like a mentor to you, like musically and kind of like philosophically, I think it's like, man, I was like, this guy and I have a lot of parallels. This is awesome. So tell me about your process. Tell me where you grew up, how you got into music. What was the moment of Zen that first got you into music?
The moment of Zen that first got me into music. Bro, there's no moment of Zen that first got me into music. That doesn't exist for me.
Well, you know, it's like you probably had it. I saw that you had a dad that was a touring musician or a professional musician.
My dad, yeah, you know, he's still to this day is doing his thing. And both my piano players. So the reason I don't have a Genesis moment is because I basically like was, I mean, when I was exposed to music since I was in the womb. My mom is a piano teacher still, and she was teaching piano then. My dad is a country rock and blues producer. So I actually joined my dad's band when I was 14. I was playing just for the hell of it because I loved it when I was younger. And then when I was 14, I was good enough to like jump on stage and sit in with my dad, and the rest of the guys were like, hey, the kid should join. Like, so I started playing around at smoky bars around Chicago. This is when smoking was still legal in Chicago bars. So even to this day, the smell of cigarette smoke is very dear to my heart, even though I've never smoked a cigarette. I don't want the health repercussions.
You're like, but that's your first entrance into gigging and performing. That's awesome.
Playing like I remember setting up on a pool table. We had a wooden plank at a place called the Wooden Nickel in Highland Park, and we would set up a wooden plank on the pool table, balance the keyboard on the wooden plank, and I would stand on the pool table and play the organ.
That's awesome. That's awesome. What kind of organ were you playing?
Well, it was an organ sound on my dad's Roland, whatever synthesizer he had at the time. I mean, he had some old, he had like the, I can't even remember the names of them, but like the really cool vintage synthesizers that, that were of that time. Like,
and what were you playing? Like Leon Russell kind of tunes, Allman Brothers?
No, actually. So we did some Allman Brothers. We did some Grateful Dead. We did a lot of like B.B. King, Buddy Guy. It was like blues and rock.
That's awesome. You're 14 years old playing all that stuff. Like, yeah. That's heavy, man. That's super heavy.
Yeah, still to this day, like, I don't actually remember all the tunes that we played, but whenever anybody calls one that band played, I know it all. It's like ingrained in my soul, even though I don't even know what song it is. I can just play through it. But then after that, when I was 15, there was another band called Bucket Shop that got wind of my like playing. You know, there's this kid in Highland Park, north of Chicago, who's tearing it up with this band called Slack Daddy, the blues band. So they got wind of that, and they're like, we want to call him and see if he'll join our bands. So these guys, and they're in their 30s and 40s at the time, led by a guy named Mark Cavanaugh, who's still a dear friend to this day. They called me up and they were like, hey, do you want to come audition for this band? And I remember I was 15 years old. I had I'd just gotten my driver's permit, and I was like, I've got to fucking do this. Like, mom and dad, can I please start going to Chicago? They're like, all right, you'll be 16 soon. You can drive back and forth. Like, and so I remember going back and forth just as a 16 year old, like driving to Chicago and back to, it was actually in Oak Park that we rehearsed, and, played all these really cool like Jean-Luc Ponty tunes and Return to Forever tunes, Mahavishnu Orchestra, Billy Cobham. Like, it was just really good fusion shit. And so I cut my teeth on that when I was 15.
Man, dude, that is crazy that you went from the blues kind of rockabilly and kind of, you know, Southern rock thing to like Mahavishnu, you know what I mean? That's like a pretty eclectic crossover to kind of make.
It is a bit of a crossover.
Was there like a little bit of an adjustment, just kind of like what you were playing for the bag, you know what I mean? Or were you just like, this just feels good, I'm going to learn what it is to do this and just do it?
I was just so excited to be playing, man. I didn't even like, I didn't even consider myself a professional. I was designing websites at the time also. I taught myself HTML. And I was like, all right, I'm going to make my living doing websites because nobody makes a living doing music. I looked at my parents and I was like, oh, I don't want to, you know, end up having to like take a day job and like give up on my dreams and like blah, blah, blah. I'll just like do something to make money and then I'll do music on the side. That was my thought when I was that age. But I loved music so much and kept getting deeper into it that then when I was applying to colleges, by that time I had built this web design company so that I was hiring some of my high school classmates and had more clients. And half of the colleges I applied to as computer science because that was the obvious thing to go into to make money. Half of them were in music.
And, oh, that's cool.
And I didn't know which one I wanted to do. But when I was when I got into a few different schools and it turned out that the most affordable one was my in-state University of Illinois. And I had happened to have applied as a music major. So I was like, fuck it. I'll just go as a music major and take some CS classes and some graphic design classes, but have my main thing be music.
So you did jazz studies, I assume?
I got in the composition department.
Oh, that's awesome.
Had won some awards for compositions that I wrote in high school. I was writing for like the high school band and orchestra when I was in high school.
That's
so
awesome.
Like it was yeah, I mean, I guess reflecting on it, it was it was a little heavy for a high schooler. I mean, I had the full
transposing, like writing for the instruments, the orchestrations are that's pretty advanced for a high school kid, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And I remember doing it. And in fact, there are some interesting memories. I don't know how I sort of figured it out, but like, because I didn't have really formal composition training, except for my senior year, there was a music composition class taught by Dan Brame, who's the high school band director there, who is a huge inspiration to me. But even before that, I remember writing for the concert band. I asked him if I could write a piece and have them play it. He was like, I guess, sure. Let's give him a break.
He's like, sure, I guess. That's cool. If you can
So I did. And I ended up writing in the song was in like 5/4.
Wow.
And I don't think we had done anything in 5/4. I don't even really know. I think I figured it out on Finale or something that you could just change the time signature and it would be cool. So I like did that. And then did all these weird modulations and shit and ended up confusing the fuck out of the kids. I still remember trying to conduct them in it and everybody getting lost and confused. But that was probably just as much because of my conducting as it was their...
Well, you're like trying to keep track of everybody making sure they got their parts and cues and then...
Yeah, you know, yeah.
You're like making it challenging for yourself. That was probably your first lesson, like simplify.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I wish I'd learned that. I still haven't learned that lesson.
So did you start kind of like wanting like to perform more? Did you start a band in college? Like what was the transition for you at that point?
I had a band in high school. That was also in addition to the Bucket Shop band that I was in, there was another band that was like a rock band. And when I was in college, I formed the first Greg Spiro trio. And it was with a guy named Gerald Gary, drummer, and Dan Wansover, bassist. And Dan was like one of the cool kids. I was super nervous to play with Dan. Gerald was just like super chill. He was my RA in my dorm in Allen Hall where I stayed. But like I got the two guys together and we started writing some tunes together and played some interesting weird fusion shit, just like kind of what I had learned from some offshoots of like Return to Forever and the stuff that I had learned. But you know, like a young college kid would be experimenting with that stuff. But we ended up getting pretty popular on campus and playing at the Canopy Club and releasing some music and stuff and winning some little awards on campus.
And was it like, did you do some straight ahead stuff? Was it kind of, you know,
I did straight ahead. I did straight ahead. I studied all straight ahead. So that was my thing. Like I got into the composition school and then transferred to the jazz school and did sort of a triple major, but I did it as an independent studies major with the three major names so that I could cut out all the basic courses that I didn't need to take at the time. So it was music composition, jazz piano performance, and graphic design.
Wow, that is crazy. So you basically had three majors.
Yeah, essentially. But I didn't have to take like the super basic stuff of graphic design. I'd already had a bunch of graphic design experience. I was able to go to the one-on-ones and the more advanced classes pretty quickly. And same with like jazz piano. I was able to, essentially it gave me the opportunity to use all the coolest gear, get into all the coolest rooms, like the practice rooms with the Steinways. I got keys too. I was so proud of that. And just like explore on an advanced level throughout my time at U of I in those 4 years, and then leave. And they tried to get me to do the master's program there, but I was like, I can't handle more school. I need to go into the real world and just play. And so then I came back to Chicago and started gigging.
And did you kind of like go back to the blues scene? Did you kind of like take this a little band bit, kind of expanded? Like, tell me about that.
A little bit. There's a blues like local legend in Chicago. His name's Les Getrix. He studied under the great blues artists in Chicago, and he's sort of a mentee of some of the masters. And so I ended up playing with him for a while when I got back. Frank Russell, a jazz blues bassist, really great guy, really great bassist, started playing in his band. And then also with Robert Irving III, who was my mentor at the time, I ended up meeting him. He's Miles Davis's music director from the 80s era. So he wrote like Decoy and a bunch of other shit. So he was my mentor since I was 19. I met him at the Self-Employment in the Arts conference that U of I had taken me to. So I ended up doing some work with him, which eventually led to my touring with the Miles Electric Band, which is all the legacy, all the guys from the 80s who played with Miles playing his music, which was super fun tours.
Dude, I don't know if I ever told you. I didn't have a chance to tell you this last night, but I met Miles Davis when I was 11.
Oh, shit. No Dude, way.
I sang backup for Mike and the Mechanics in the Grammy Awards in 1990, and he was performing. So I got to watch him rehearse. And, like, I didn't, you know, I was 11 years old. I didn't know who Miles Davis was. I was 11.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I remember, like, it was like an empty Shrine Auditorium, and I was watching him play, and I was like, man, someday this guy's going to be huge. Not knowing that he was already like the legend of legends. So I ended up
at the end of his life.
All I did was just bump into him backstage. And I was like, oh, sorry. And he was like, oh, it's cool, man. It's cool. It's cool. He like, it was Aww. Like, oh. But I remember he had a vibe. Like, I remember kind of like rounding the corner, and I could tell, I could feel like somebody large, like their presence was looming like right around that corner. So, but I got to watch him rehearse. So like Miles Davis, when I got to college, I lived with all jazz musicians, and it was like, you know, that's where I just totally got into Kind of Blue, Bitches Brew, like all the Miles records, and it kind of like was transformative. Was the Electric period your favorite period, or did you kind of like, is that the one that you just, all the cats wanted to play in?
And you know, I oscillate between the Electric period and like the like late 60s period.
That's my like favorite. All the like, bebop stuff, Charlie Parker, like, oh my god, so good.
Well the stuff with the late 60s with like Wayne Shorter and Ron Carter and Tony Williams, and like that band, which I, there are two videos that I would watch when this was in my early 20s. When I came back from college, I had a bit of a quarter life crisis. I was doing business and I was doing music, and I was gigging 6 nights a week, working on business during the day, and was so not excelling at either of them because I was just spending too much time split. So I got very depressed and was seeking like, what am I going to, how am I going to change my life? I needed to make a major change. Wasn't sure what it was going to be. That's when I went to, Bobby Irving, and I was like, listen, I've got to make a change, and I want to ask the master. I want to go to the temple, like, theoretically, like, go to the master in the temple and ask him what the fuck to do. For me, that person was Herbie Hancock. I was like, I need to ask him if he will teach me, like, and mentor me in this sort of, like, I guess just life in general, like, as a creative person, because he had done it so well in my eyes. And so Babe was like, okay, go sneak backstage at a concert and meet him, like go early before sound check and then like catch him after sound check. It's like, okay, cool. So Herbie was playing at Ravinia Festival in Chicago, just north of Chicago, right in Highland Park where I lived at the time. And so I put on a suit and got my backpack, snuck backstage, just walked past the guards, waved to them like, hello, I'm supposed to be here, and just kept walking. And then followed him around like a little puppy dog for like, I don't know, hours until I got the chance to talk to him. And I started asking him these intellectual questions about music, because I was like, this, he's gotta be into this shit. Like, you know, the motivic use of his like themes and harmonies and how he changes shit and like all this stuff. And like, he had no interest in talking to me about that. So eventually, after like a couple hours of this, I found my way into some little, him talking with a couple people, with this Japanese woman and this like other guy. And I kind of made my way into the circle. I was about to ask him another question, and somebody grabs my backpack and pulls me back. And he whispers in my ear, this dude, he says, ask him how to bring out your greatest creative potential. And then puts me back. I'm like, wow. What the fuck? and it's this dude with long hair, like, saying, I'm like, all right, thanks, I guess. And I'm like, well, what else am I going to do? So I asked him, how do I bring out my greatest creative potential? And he was like, oh, I've got something you should check out. And he takes me to the green room and he shows me this scroll. It's a Gohanzen. And he says, we chant the words Nam-myoho Renge-kyo. And that's how I bring out my greatest creative potential. And you may want to try it. You want to try it? I'm like, yeah, cool, please. So we sit down, we start chanting Nam-myoho Renge-kyo, and then he goes on and plays a show. I go back into the audience. My family's there. They're like, what happened? I'm like, I was hanging with Herbie. And then I go backstage afterwards again and start talking to him more. And we talk for like 4 hours until the end of the night. And he's telling me all this interesting shit about Buddhism, because I actually had a deep interest in spirituality and in meditation before this, but I hadn't connected the dots with that. I've never heard of that particular kind of Buddhism. So he told me about it and I was immediately interested. And so then by the end of the night, I was like, okay, I got to try this out. I know enough about it. Herbie, if Herbie uses this to bring out his creativity, I have to give it a shot. So I started chanting for 2 minutes every day after that. And my life started changing in these little weird, subtle ways. Like, I got the opportunity to take a trip to Thailand for a month with an ex-girlfriend of mine. She invited me and I was like, I would never fucking do that. It sounds like the worst idea, but I was like, listen, I'm in this state of depression. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm trying to figure my shit out. I wasn't really in touch with Herbie for a little bit after I'd talked to him that night, but I was trying this thing out, this chanting. I was like, fuck it, I'll try it. What do I have to lose? So I went to Thailand for a month, cut off all my contacts back in the US. And I like my business people who were hiring me to do business for them, I literally just put them in touch with the people I was hiring and was like, you guys handle it. I'm done. I'm out. I'm going to Thailand and I'm not dealing with this right now. So I went to Thailand. I didn't touch a piano for a month for the first time in my life that I could remember. And by the time I got back, my mentality was transformed. I was like, because I stayed with villagers that lived on a dollar a day or less and like was going around this place where people were genuinely happy and they were genuinely in touch with family and their social environment, and they had no money whatsoever. I was like, man, I'm doing all this work, charging all this money so that I can like, I don't even know what I'm going to use it for, doing all this business. Like, I just kept buying more musical gear. So I was like, fuck it. You know what? I'm done with business for now. I'm going to just do music. And so at that point, I cut off all my business contacts and I decided that I was 23 at the time. And I said, I'm just doing music. This is it for as like, you know, the foreseeable future. I'm done with business. And that's when I started every night. This goes back to what I was going to tell you before, full circle. This is when I started every night to listen to a record as I went to sleep. And the first record that I would listen to as I went to sleep was a DVD that I had bought while I was in high school of the Miles Electric Band in Paris in 1989, and it was with Kenny Garrett on sax.
I was just about to ask if Kenny Garrett was on that. Well, that's where he's like, he does this shit every night, right?
Yeah, exactly. Foley just killing it on the treble bass. Man, the like that video, I watched it every single night for like probably 6 months at that time. When I got back, I'm like, I'm just gonna learn what the fuck is going on. I learned every little nuance, understood every little aspect of what was happening on stage, the dynamics, the music. And then after that went on to that after that, I found the late 60s videos with Wayne, and with Ron Carter and Tony Williams and Herbie. And then I started listening to that, and that I couldn't understand at the time. My ear couldn't decipher what was going on. But I was like,
out. There's a lot of out stuff.
It's out, and it's complex, and it's so, it's like there's so much movement and there's so much understanding, but it's like you have to have the understanding to flow with the movement.
Well, that, what's really cool about Herbie too, it's like, you know, I saw him, I think it was like 2005, and he was at this period where like time was ambiguous, and it was he and I think it was Roy Hargrove, Wayne Shorter, and they were kind of doing this kind of like music where it was like there was no groove, and they were just kind of like avant-garde composing, improvising, all like on the spot, and time was ambiguous. And I'm like, this makes total sense, because he's done everything from bebop to funk to pop to, of course, this is where he's at, because it's like, and now he's coming back. It was 2003, 2004. I saw him at the
Bowl. That's when he was doing the New Directions in music.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, and with Brecker. So it was Hargrove and Brecker and Herbie headlining with my man. K, his name starts with K. Kendrick on drums.
And that was with Roy Hargrove too on trumpet, I believe.
Yeah.
That was the last time I saw Brecker, because they did that performance. They did that performance at USC, I think my junior or senior year, and that was the last time I saw Brecker play.
Yeah,
he did like Coltrane's Naima. And it was just like,
I saw that same concert, man.
Man,
I saw
that
when they went
heavy,
to U of I.
Heavy, yep.
Bro, when they did that at U of I, it was sold out. I couldn't get a ticket to it, so I put on all black and I got a bunch of mic cables. And I just ran into the backstage area. I was like, hey, I got to get these to the stage. And just like, then when I got to the stage, pulled out my little flip cell phone, because I didn't have, there was no iPhone at the time, and like pretended to be really mad, like at somebody on the phone, so nobody would come and interrupt me as I was like doing, and then, until the concert started, and then just put my phone away and watched the whole concert from backstage.
That's super smart, dude. That's pretty good. Yeah. That's pretty epic. We're going to get along great, by the way. That's slamming. But yes, no, I mean, it's like, you know, I think Kind of Blue is 58. Is that right? Something around there. I think Kind of Blue is, you know.
Maybe 59. Let's see.
58, 59, something like that. So like that era for me kind of like blew my 59. Mind. Because it was just like, it was, you know, kind of at the beginning of, I really feel like where jazz was like really taking off, you know, it became like, it almost became like pop music. Jazz was so big, you know?
And well, I don't know. I didn't live through that era, but from what I'm told, Sony almost didn't release Kind of Blue.
Yeah. I've heard that too.
They were, it was actually like such a risk to release a jazz record at that time. It was the golden year of jazz for that time, historically, looking back retrospectively, because you have, I think that's is that the same year that that Love Supreme came out? It was at least right around that year.
Yeah, it was around that. It was around. They're within 1 or 2 years apart. You're talking about Coltrane, right?
Yeah. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Love Supreme was 65. What was it that was in 59? Because there was another, I think there, oh, was it,
Coltrane Blue Train?
Maybe it was Giant Steps. Well, let's see. Let's see. Coltrane album 1959. The internet will tell us.
I'm curious about this too, actually.
Was it Giant Steps? I think it might have been Giant Steps.
I thought Giant
Steps. It was released February 1960. It was released February 1960. So, you know, that's the same period. So you have.
I feel like Kind of Blue was like the first, like, really, like, huge jazz record. You know, like, I kind of feel like there were a lot of great jazz records before that. But, I mean, Charlie Parker was huge. But, I mean, they were all doing, like, Cole Porter. It was a different thing because it was all, like, compositional. You know, it was like they weren't covering any, like, show tunes. You know what I mean? It was like they were kind of went on this journey of just embarking on something new, completely new material, which is, like, you know, what I feel like jazz is missing now. It's like, it's, you know, there's so much going on with jazz and it's like, there's no direction, you know, whereas there was like, you had like elements of bebop and then you had elements of experimental and like you had all these eras and, you know, Miles was kind of like in all of that with Herbie and Coltrane too, you know? So like, you know, all those, that era for me, that late 50s, early 60s is like some of my favorite jazz that I think I'll ever listen to just because, and then, you know, always funk music and stuff like that. But how did that, you know, music influence you and your playing as an artist? Like you had to draw from that somehow. Tell me how that kind of became a voice for you.
How did the music like Kind of Blue and Giant Steps and Coltrane and all of that? I mean, that was the foundation of my education. Like the
because you were saying you were out of college and you went to Thailand. You decided to come back and play music. What was the voice that you were kind of creating for that?
Well, okay, so that was when I got back from Thailand and I started immersing myself in music that would become the foundation for my next like development of my next musical development. I listened to those records, but it wasn't those records that formed the foundation at that point. Those were like the foundations of my studies. I studied Giant Steps. I transcribed tons of the solos from Kind of Blue. I could still play, like I can sing the entire record.
So good.
Like, you know, but the things that served my foundation for those following years actually were the newer cats. I was listening to so much Brad Meldow.
He's one of my favorites.
Yeah, and Keith Jarrett, like the standards era from him, it's just some of the best playing, like in the history of recorded music. His level of I attribute, and this is actually I get this from a professor of mine named Guy Garnett from U of I, who had this amazing universal understanding of music that I've never heard anybody else explain as well as he explained it. But the essence of Keith Jarrett is like the essence of Volpa. Volpa is this postmodern classical composer or whatever the hell you call it, like very atonal, weird shit, but takes into consideration. Yeah. Like all of the new, I mean, but you know, early
like Schoenberg, like all of the, I know what you're talking about. Johnny
yeah,
Cage,
that yeah. of that era. But Schoenberg stayed in his own lane, right? Cage had his own lane. Like they had very specific lanes of what they were doing. You know, Cage doing like the weird, more like surprising, like right. thinking and make you think about what the fuck is going on. Schoenberg using 12 tone and being
mathematical,
but intuitive also. Like he had interesting weird games that he would play to do his compositions, like with dice and all this stuff. But Volpa took all of it and like the nuances of all the different sects that were happening in that like atonal modern classical era. He took that into account, and Keith Jarrett did that for jazz in his standards. In his standards recordings, because he was able to like, he used all of the motivic nuance of the most modern jazz players, like the and obviously of classical, because that's all drawn from classical in the first place. But but also like the soulfulness and the feel of the most like gritty bluesy players. And
Keith Jarrett's one of my favorite players, but not one of my favorite people. Like he's got like this gritty edge, like where he won't like, he doesn't like people coming in late to his shows. Like he doesn't like anybody like taking. He's on a level.
Keith Jarrett's
earned it.
Jarrett's just real, man. Keith Jarrett, he's a douchebag, but it's like, yeah. Of course, it's like I saw him. I've seen him live as much as I've been able to, and he did a rant one time when somebody like was up taking, somebody took a picture, and he was like, man, what the fuck are you taking a picture for? Like, I'm here playing for you, and like you just took a moment of time out of your present moment so that you could snap and see a little guy in a red shirt on a stage. Like, what the hell are you doing? And it's like, he's right. What the hell is this guy doing? Like,
true.
You know, when he stopped playing that festival because there were planes flying overhead, and right. Like they planned a festival underneath air traffic, like where there would be all this noise and shit. You know, he's right. And I'm with Keith Jarrett on that stuff. I think people are idiots. Like,
that's true. I mean, he's definitely earned that respect to like, mm-hmm. he's a great jazz performer. But I think also it's like, you can't chastise your audience when their audience supports your craft. It's like, dude, it's like you just can't do that. It's like, they're
yeah,
they're
he was making so much money, you just didn't care.
Right. And like, I think that's where the lack of humility sometimes falls. It's like, if he was a struggling jazz musician where nobody knew who he was, man, I wonder if he'd be the same person or if he would just be way more humble and just gracious, you know. That's a debate for another day. But I love his music. I love his playing. I cannot say anything about that. But I've just seen so many performances where he does that, those rants, and it's like, dude, you have so much music in you. Just focus on that. Like, just who cares about everybody else? Just play, you know. Like,
I feel you. But I will say one thing about like, we're talking about something that could be. We could be talking about niceness. You could call it kindness, which are two very different things, but like both of those could fall into this bucket. Like, I have a lot of respect for people who are not nice.
Right.
I have a lot of respect for people who are willing to, no matter how abrasive or like wrong they might be even, that they will speak their mind in that moment because you know exactly what the fuck they think.
Right.
And everybody else around that person can make their own decisions for themselves to like react how they want or walk away or whatever, or have conversation. But that person is giving you exactly their truth at that moment. And I think that that's something that's lacking in the music industry.
Oh yeah. Sure.
Because a lot of people are yes people to each other. And you know, it's like somebody plays a shitty gig and you go like, oh, it's great, man. Yeah. Great. It's like, what the fuck is that person getting out of it? Actually, they should be told that they suck, so that they can go home and practice and they stop getting on stage and sucking every night, and they actually spend the time to go and shed more and make the decisions that they should make for their own career to like get to where they want to go. But instead, people are like gaslit into thinking that they're good because everybody else just doesn't want to offend them and wants them to like them. So yeah. Like, that's an ecosystem that's toxic. And I think we live in that in the jazz world. So when you have somebody like Keith Jarrett, and this is why I like sort of stand on this kind of hill with that, when you have somebody like Keith Jarrett who it will never tell you anything to please you, he will only tell you exactly what he thinks. I just have so much respect for that. My first mixing engineer was like that. Craig Bauer is his name. He's a fucking dick, and I love the dude so much. Like, and he, right. You know, maybe he'll hear this interview and he'll get exactly what I'm saying, because I have so much respect for him. Like, because, you know, if you are doing something in your mix or in your music that and it doesn't make any sense, he'll tell you, like,
he'll be like, I need to show you. Let's play something real quick of one of your songs. What do you want to play first?
Okay.
I want to get to your music. We got 20
minutes.
Let's
do it, man. Let's do it. Okay. So, shit. Let's do the Chicago Experiment. This is one. I released the Chicago Experiment as my most recent record. And we're about to release, starting in excuse me, in December, we're releasing the next iteration of it, the Chicago Experiment Part 2. So this is off the upcoming Chicago Experiment Part 2. I think it's the first single we're releasing called Under Earth.
Here's Under Earth. Oh, wait, I guess we don't have that one. What? I don't, Sam said we don't have
it's
that.
It's the YouTube video.
Hold on. Sam, do we have the YouTube video? Let's see. Let me see. Hold on. Hold that thought. Hold that thought.
Maybe I didn't send. Let's see.
We have, I'll tell you what we have. We have The Chant, Always Be, and Rose Petal.
Well, it's from the previous email with the YouTube videos.
Okay, let me see.
Yeah, there it is. Under Earth, Green Light, Straight Shooter. Here, want me to forward it to you?
All right. He says he can't get it now, but let's do. We'll get it after the second one. Why don't we play one of the MP3s first?
Okay, great. Let's do. Let's see what do we got there.
Let me see what we have. We have The Rose, The Chant, and
let's do The Chant. Let's do The Chant. That's the first one from the Chicago Experiment. That was the original single. That's okay. A fun one.
Here's The Chant by Greg Spiro and the Chicago Experiment.
Thank you.
That was slamming, dude. Who was playing bass on that? Who was playing bass?
It's Daryl Jones.
Oh, man, from the Stones. Dude, what a pocket, dude. It's just grooving.
Bro, I know. He's from Chicago as well. He's he lives in L.A., though. That's what I know him from Chicago because he would come back. We would co-write some stuff together and perform together, and then we ended up touring with the Miles Electric Band because he played with Miles also.
Oh, man. So he was in the electric period, right? He didn't do all the upright stuff. He didn't do any of the upright stuff.
No, he plays upright, but he didn't with Miles, I believe.
So I'm doing a blues trio record right now. I don't know if you know Gene Coy? Gene mm-hmm. Coy? So Gene Coy and a guy named Andre De Santana, we started a blues trio together. And so I reached out to Chuck Lavelle, who's like one of my favorite pianists. And I was like, hey, man, we're going to do Old Love, Eric Clapton. You kind of changed my life when I first heard you play that with him. Mm-hmm. Be down to play it. And he said, yeah, man. So he's actually playing on an original of ours and on Old Love. So, like, man, we got the Rolling Stones connection too, man. This is crazy. Dude, that tune is grooving. It was very much like Maceo Parker, Life on Planet Groove, mixed with, like, a Miles Davis tune. You know, it was just, like, the funk and groove and the pocket.
Thanks, man.
Jazz experimentation. It's very
that cool. was just an improvisation. That was like wow. literally captured during the session. I had 12 tunes I came with, and we ended up improvising for a large part of the session, and that was just chopped right out of one of the improvs. And then I overdubbed a sax, Irvin Pierce. He went and overdubbed some sax on it, and then and Joel Ross also he went and overdubbed some vibes. But like the original with Daryl and Jeff Parker and Makai McCraven and me and Marquise Hill, that was all just straight up improvisation.
Awesome. Well, it's like so great when you work with great players. It's just it becomes easy to find something out of nothing. You know what I mean? Yep. So I'm sure it just kind of appeared and approached itself that way. You know. Mm-hmm. So tell me. So you know we're gonna get back to this jazz stuff, but you were also you've been working with Halsey and you've been working with her for a while. Tell me how that transition in your career, what was that like? Because you come from jazz, blues, fusion, and then you're instantly thrown into this pop world, which is like none of that. You know what I mean? It's like a totally different world. Tell me what that transition was for you as a creator and just like to be supportive of her vision and kind of like work on, you know, sounds and songs.
Man. Yeah, the pop world, man, that's an interesting world. So when I came to LA, I was 27 years old and I was like, I won the award for best jazz entertainer in Chicago. And I was like, I need a bigger pond. And I want to try my hand at something that could get bigger than I could get if I just stuck with what I'm doing right now, which is jazz. So I came to LA. Played at sessions for a long time, eventually found my way connected with this girl, Ashley Frangipani, who was starting her project. She had just done a little tour opening for the Kooks, just got signed to Astralworks for one little mini viral song that she had that had like, it wasn't even that big. It was called Ghost at the time. It was off her first EP called like Room 94 or something like that. We met and long story short, she wanted me to be in the band and, I almost didn't do it. I was deciding between that and this other band that I was in that was doing like corporate gigs, travel for corporate shit, you know, really good paying stuff. And the Halsey tour wasn't going to pay that much. And she had 15,000 Instagram followers at the time. She wasn't very big. I was like, we none of us knew if this project would take off or not. I was like, you know what? Fuck it. Let's just give it a shot. So I went.
Wow.
We did our first tour, 200 cap rooms, double bill with Young Rising Suns. Another little band. It's still pretty little at this point. I love those dudes so much. We had so much fun. But we were in a 12-person tour bus with 14 people in it. And
wow.
two people sleeping in the lobby. Everybody was partying up all night, every night, like shots of Jack. I was sitting there trying to meditate at like the entire tour. And it was fucking crazy. Like, Crazy, man. So many stories. Most of which I won't.
Yeah. That's another private conversation.
but like we grew that thing, and I got, you know, I grew with it. We eventually, I mean, that was sort of, for better or for worse, that was my claim to fame. Not that the music was any better than any of the other music I was playing at any other point, but like, you know, pop shit, when it gets big, people love to include you in shit.
Right,
and
right.
So eventually it got really big, and to the point where like it had essentially made my career up to that point. And I have a huge debt of gratitude to her for, because it was really her, like, dealing with her fans in a way that got her so famous, that got the group so famous. You know, we took it to the moon. And then on my, we had played like most of the late night talk shows by 2018. We had played Colbert, Fallon, Ellen, Kimmel, you name it. We hadn't played SNL yet. And so I was like ready to go at that point. I was like, listen, I can't take this anymore. I need to go back to jazz. Like, I'm not a pop player.
Right.
I can play pop, and I can play it much better now because I did that project, but
it doesn't
and
fill your soul. Yeah, I know.
It doesn't fill my soul. I decided to resign at that point and put in my resignation on the day that we played SNL, for the first time. And so it was this big moment, and press covered it and all this stuff. And, then moved on to build Tiny Room Studios, which is what I'm in right now. It was a journey. I mean, we took it from our first show to 80 people, where she fainted on stage and I carried her off, to Madison Square Garden being sold out multiple times.
Wow.
The Forum, like, I mean, every arena in the major cities in the US. And then I was like, it's time to move on and do some other shit, go back to my roots. So I left the group, rented out a small room in Burbank. Started the Tiny Room everything, like the
let's play something. And then we're going to talk about Tiny Room, because I want to get to some of your music too, because you're a musician, we're going to talk about music. So what do you want to do? The Rose, or do you want to do the other one?
Rose is great.
All right, this is The Rose, Greg Spiro. We'll be right back. Dude, that was so grooving, man. That was straight out of Herbie Hancock Thrust, man. This is like the sequel, dude. It's like you're playing all my favorite stuff, dude. This is like we got to just jam and hang outside of this show because we definitely have the same musical kind of influences. Real quick, so tell me about Tiny Room Studios. We're running out of time. We got into this. It's kind of cool. We got into this huge music talk. Those are kind of my favorite interviews because it's like you don't realize the camera's on. You're just like in the music talk. But you started Tiny Room Studios. I came there yesterday. I'd never seen it, and it was such a cool space. Tell us a little bit about it.
All right, I'll make the long story very short. In that when I first left the Halsey tour, I would say like creatively I needed to immerse myself in creativity. I felt creatively drained. I was playing the same songs for years and they're relatively simple songs, beautiful music, but simple for my tastes. And so I was like, all right, I'm going to live my music. I rented this 12-foot by 16-foot room in a warehouse in Burbank, brought my grand piano there. I had also just got out of, I had a house in Atlanta before that with my fiance at the time, who I had just broken up with. So I took my piano and brought it to LA, put it in this 12-foot by 16-foot room, and just lived there. I had a tatami mat that I slept on the floor every night, and then I would wake up in the morning, have coffee, go to the piano and play and compose, and then at night I would have friends come over and I would record. And I gradually bought more and more gear until I had a full video suite and a full like mixing situation. I bought all the backline, and it was just this very small room, but made really efficiently to like just have everything that I needed to be creative and have all my friends come and be creative with me. So that's how Tiny Room came to be. It by the end of year two, it was like fully self-sustaining as a studio. We grew into a little bit of a bigger space, and then the pandemic hit.
Right.
So then I was in a bigger space. There was more rent and we had to close it. That's when I started my software company, Pitch, which is a totally different conversation. You probably don't even know about that.
No, I checked it out actually. It's cool.
Okay.
It's very cool.
And I worked on that for a couple of years until I'm still working on it. But then in January of this year, I reopened the new Tiny Room Studio in Inglewood on 68th and West Boulevard. And so now it's this cultural hub where we have musicians come every week. Every Monday, we invite the community in, have a big blowout with drinks and food and just amazing music. It's a 7-camera setup with like 32-channel mixer, like all the shit that we need to have it be a really amazing musical space. And it's kind of like it's much bigger. It's a 3,400 square foot warehouse now, as you saw.
Yeah, it's awesome.
And we built in a whiskey cigar lounge. We built in dedicated recording and mixing rooms. And then the big main stage with a 37 piece lighting rig. That's what it is now. It's humming. I mean, tonight we had Olive Klug. She came and did a singer-songwriter night. Every Tuesday we do a singer-songwriter night. We put that out on a live stream every week. We're going to be releasing it as vinyls through my label, Tiny Records. And so it's a whole ecosystem now. It's just kind of grown, and I'm letting it organically manifest into whatever it's going to manifest into. It's become this sort of beautiful creative mecca.
Dude, you are a wonderful cat, and I love what you're doing for music, what you're doing for artists, what you're doing for yourself. You've kind of gotten this taste of everything, and you're kind of like living that monk life, man. You're like chanting and channeling, and that's what it's all about. And we need to grab a cup of coffee and talk shop outside of this interview. But for now, I just want to say I want to have you back. What I usually do with this show is I have artists come back every 9 or 10 months with releases or new music or new things that they're working on or new projects, and showcase everything that you're doing. This is a long-term kind of exposure for artists. So
how often do you do this show?
Every Tuesday night. I've been doing it for about 7 or 8 years. I had Victor Wooten on a couple weeks ago. I had Jeff Coffin for the saxophonist for Dave Matthews Band.
Yeah, Jeff is great.
I had Ken Calais, John Alasia, great producers in L.A. Yeah, man, just all kinds of filmmakers. This is why I wanted to start this, is for the community to have a vessel and a vehicle to showcase artists, man. So you and I are going to collaborate, and we're going to talk shop. And, yeah, man, it's not the end of this connection. But for now, we're going to end this interview because we can only do it about an hour. But thank you for being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood, man. We're going to continue this story and bring you back. So in the meantime, you and I are going to work on some music, and we'll talk shop, okay?
Awesome. All right. Thanks so much for having me, Nikki. I really appreciate it.
Last question real quick. Where can people find you if they want to find Tiny Room Studios and all that good stuff?
So Tiny Room Studios, if you look up Tiny Room Studios LA on Instagram, or look me up, Greg Spiro, G-R-E-G-S-P-E-R-O, as it says there on Instagram. Just on the internet, you know, look up Tiny Room Studios or Greg Spiro.
Look them up, people. Find Greg in the tiny room.
Yeah, you can find me here every day, actually. So just come by on a Monday night, especially.
Definitely come by on a Monday night, and we'll definitely make this happen. And you know what? I'm thank you for being a guest tonight. And here's to many more hangs, dude. We'll have to continue this Miles Davis and jazz conversation, because that's one I can get behind for sure, dude.
Oh yeah, looking forward to it, man.
Awesome. On behalf of Greg, myself, and Sam, thanks everybody for tuning in. We'll see you guys next week. Peace and love. Peace.
Listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Corulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.